All righty, thank you for joining me tonight. And I want to start by saying that in 1980, when I took the oath of Hippocrates as a graduate newly minted from medical school, the oath said essentially, when the doctor enters the house of the patient, they only enter for the good of the patient. And I remember thinking, whom else would you be there for? Well, now we know. Because now this year in 2024, the University of Pittsburgh medical students have written their own oath. This is a new trend. It was done years ago in Arizona. Now it's come to the Pittsburgh School of Medicine class of 2024. And this is how they end. They acknowledge, they're saying, or they start, they say they're acknowledging the privilege and responsibility that come with being a physician. I take this oath as a call to action to fulfill my duty to my patients, to the medical profession, and to society. Well, it sounds good, but what happens when society doesn't value your life? When society decides that there's a group of people that don't get the care, that we don't care about them so much. We only care about these guys, not you. And that's what we're going to talk about tonight. Scott Sharrow is here, and it's a tragedy about his daughter, but we'll be right back to talk about that. Rebel is a code when you go to the store, and we'll be back. Thank you.
The Brighteon store understands the importance of getting all the nutrients you need to support the healthy functions of your body. Our nutrient-dense superfoods and supplements can help nourish your body and promote your optimal health and well-being. 100% customer satisfaction guarantee on all purchases. You deserve the best. BrighteonStore.com. Support this amazing platform and amazing Patriots for Humanity.
Use promo code REBEL at checkout for additional savings.
The world we once knew is collapsing. We're being warned to expect rolling blackouts, and our political leaders are deliberately shutting down pipelines, fuel refineries, nuclear power plants, and energy exploration. The currency is collapsing, while financial assets are plummeting in value, and the global food supply is being deliberately decimated. To survive this war being waged on humanity, you need more than just regular prepping. You need resilient prepping. And that's the title of my new free audiobook, Resilient Prepping. You can download the entire audiobook and a printable PDF transcript for free right now at resilientprepping.com. Resilient Prepping teaches practical strategies for prepping in three layers: high-tech, low-tech, and no-tech. Resilient Prepping is your ultimate guide to surviving the total collapse of the world as we know it, because that's exactly what globalists are trying to achieve. Download this entire audiobook for free right now at resilientprepping.com.
All righty. Now I feel we've had a proper opening. I'm Dr. Lee Merritt, once an orthopedic and spinal surgeon, and now your professional medical rebel. And tonight, Scott Shara, I don't think he needs much introduction. Many of us have heard of the story of his daughter, but thank you for coming on tonight.
Well, thanks for having me.
And I'm so sorry that we have to be here under these circumstances. This is awful. But tell us, you know, I know the story in general, but why don't you tell us the story, what's happened and what you've been doing?
Well, I have to start the story way back, because if it wasn't for Grace, I wouldn't be here. And Grace was born on September 22nd of 2002, and she was born as a gift from God, and she was a gift. She died. Her last day on this earth was October 13th of 21. She was 19 years old. Grace had Down syndrome. And for those of you who have never experienced somebody with Down syndrome, they're the best person that you could ever have in your life. And, you know, Grace showed love like nobody I've ever seen. I mean, she loved me unconditionally. She's the only one that I can say outside of our Lord that loved me unconditionally. And she did that even when I was a jerk, which is most of the time. Anyway, so just a quick story about Grace, so people can kind of get a flavor for why I'm doing this. So she on top of being very high functioning, I mean, she could read and write, she played violin, I taught her how to drive a car, she deer hunted with me, but her sense of humor, that's what I really miss the most. And one of the things that I like to share, she never got her driver's license because she died too early. But when she turned 18, she wanted to vote. So we had to go to the Department of Motor Vehicles and get an ID. We went in to get the ID, and then her and I set up an appointment with the branch manager at the local credit union to get a checking account for her. So we did that. The branch manager then said, Grace, would you also like a credit card? And she said, well, of course. And so the manager said, well, what would you like the limit to be? And Grace said 30. And the manager said $30. And Grace said, no, 30,000. So she got that. She knew mom and dad were going to be on the hook for the credit card. So we might as well let her snap. So I really miss her sense of humor. She was an absolute joy to have. So what happened, the short version of the story is, in October of 21, October 1st specifically, we were going to go to a wedding. Grace had a cold, not really bad, but we just thought, well, we better test her for COVID, because if she's got COVID, we don't want to go to the wedding. So my wife, Cindy, went to town, got a home COVID test. She tested positive, so we didn't go to the wedding. We had all the FLCCC protocol at home, so we started that. She was on ivermectin, vitamins. We started measuring her oxygen saturation with a pulse ox. Ultimately, on October 6th, her oxygen saturation went to 88%. And the protocol at that time said, if the oxygen saturation drops below 94%, admit yourself to the hospital. So we went to the emergency room and ultimately admitted Grace to the hospital, and she died 7 days later. And it's hard to grasp, because, you know, they did everything in their power to take her out. You know, she went in with a bad cold. When she was just on 2 liters of oxygen in the ER, she's at in the high 90 percentile, you know, and she's doing fine. The first day in the hospital, her and I just goofed off. You know, it was really just a fun day. But as things progressed, they really set the stage that Grace needed to be ventilated, which of course was not true. And we denied the ventilator 5 different times, and she was never vented. Ultimately, on Grace's last day, we received a call from the doctor. At this point, I had already been taken out by an armed guard. My daughter, Jessica, was now in the room as a replacement advocate for Grace. On October 13th, that morning, the doctor called Cindy and I at home saying, Grace had such a good day yesterday, we should work on nutrition. This was after he said he had requested for the 5th time now that morning that we give him a pre-authorization or pre-approval for a ventilator just in case. And so after we said no for that 5th time, he immediately switched gears to, Grace had such a good day, let's work on nutrition. And it was all a bunch of lies. As we mapped things out with the records, we learned that while we were on the phone with him, they increased a dose of a sedation med called Presidex to 14 times the dose they had started her on 4.5 days earlier, the maximum allowable dose. Simultaneous with hanging up the phone with us, the doctor put an illegal do not resuscitate order on Grace's life. Then, as that day progressed, they combined Presidex with lorazepam and morphine, ultimately in a 29-minute window, which is what you do when somebody is in hospice care in the last hour of their life to euthanize them. So Grace was euthanized by that med combination. When it came time to revive her, my daughter Jessica, of course, was panicking. She called Cindy and I at home on a FaceTime call. We were clueless that Grace was even in that condition. And when we started screaming for the nurses to save our daughter, that's when we learned there's a DNR order, because they hollered back, she's DNR. And we hollered, she's not DNR, save our daughter. No doctor or nurse came in the room after they gave Grace morphine until she was dead. And, you know, that's it. It's so egregious. And, you know, ultimately, Dr. Merritt, as I dug through the records, you know, we got the records after Grace died, of course. And as I dug through those records, in April of 2022, I realized she was murdered. And after that, that opened up a whole series of doors to wake me up as to what's really going on.
Yeah, it's hard not to hear that story and think that. I mean, it's an unbelievable story. What was the reason they were even sedating her to begin with? Was she agitated?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. Grace was not an agitated child.
Doesn't sound like it.
Yeah, she was just great. I mean, there's absolutely no reason to use Presidex, but as I've studied it now, subsequent to her death, I learned that there's three reasons that they put a patient on Presidex with COVID as a diagnosis. The first one is to set up a ventilator. So they're really wanting a ventilator for every patient. Why? Because a ventilator is approximately a $300,000 payday. And so in order to vent somebody, they have to be sedated. The second reason, which I found out after receiving the invoice from the hospital, is the room charge gets changed from a regular room charge to an ICU room charge once a patient is sedated. Grace never changed rooms, nor did the care change, but the charge changed. And maybe the most important reason they do it is the patient, at the point they're on any sedation med, they're considered AMA again. So if you wanted to, so when I got taken up by an armed guard, if I said I'm taking Grace with me, they would have waved the AMA against medical advice flag to stop me from taking her. And basically it's a threat that you are responsible not only for the bill, but for the patient. And you know, you're familiar with that, of course. So that's what I've discerned relative to why she was on Presidex. You know, of course, when you look at records, their records become, unfortunately, prima facie evidence in court. And we're going to find that out because we have a lawsuit. But we also kept contemporaneous records. When I say we, that's my daughter and myself. So, you know, when we laid our records out against what they said, you can see the lies are all over the place. So they'll use the excuse Grace was agitated. That's a complete lie. I was there October 9th. That's when they started Presidex. No informed consent whatsoever. They start Presidex. Well, Grace wasn't agitated. I'm with her. She was fine. So what's the purpose? I mean, the purpose is just what I explained.
Well, and the issue of informed consent is key. I mean, there, you know, and I get it. There, when somebody comes in the emergency room and you know, there is a global consent because you're in an emergency. Sometimes that happens. You can't stop and get a consent for every medicine and whatever. But what I discovered, and this was in my husband's situation, when he went into the hospital, he didn't have COVID. I knew he didn't have COVID, but they tested him. And see, I knew about the COVID test. The COVID tests were so false. Early on, I had checked the gene sequence of the COVID, what they were testing for. Now, we have 3.1 billion bases in our genome, and they're going to try and tell us they can take 16, put it in our nose, and then wave it in the air and then come up and tell you have a disease or not. Even the, you know, the Nobel laureate, Carrie Mullis, who invented the PCR, said that you can never use this for diagnosis. But beyond all that, I said, why are these things always turning up positive? Yes, they were overcycling them, but I ran those 16 bases in the data bank, the gene bank, on the BLAST program. And at first, and they've changed it, but at first they all came up Homo sapiens gene 5, Homo sapiens gene 8, Homo sapiens. So they were testing to our own genome. I just want to make that point. I believe that to be true. Now, the second thing, though, is they treated my husband with some things that we would never have agreed to, like yours. And mm-hmm. he was goofy because the only reason I had to bring him in is I ran out of IV bags at home and I couldn't keep him hydrated. He just couldn't keep hydrated. But he had, as it turned out, we know this in After Effect, he had bacterial pneumonia. And now they're kind of coming out saying, so they, and when we called him on it, on the bill, this is apparently how you found out about some things. You find them out for the first time because it shows up on the bill. You didn't know anything about the treatment. And then it showed up on the bill. And I got a letter recently from the head administrator saying, well, it was verbal consent. Really? Verbal consent now is okay? I mean, I just, from a moral standpoint, it's disgusting, but it's also surprising. They think they can get away with this in their own, they've changed the legal system to make this possible, I guess. Now, I mean, I know you have a legal case, and I hope you very, very much that you succeed, because this is totally unethical medicine.
Well, I of course agree with you 100%. And they have changed the legal system. Of course, the PrEP Act was put in place to give immunity from liability, you know, with this fake COVID diagnosis. But, you know, the PrEP Act fortunately has provisions that if it's intentional, the PrEP Act doesn't apply. Well, that's of course, I mean, that's logical. But, you know, the provisions were way in advance of COVID. So just to file a case, so in our lawsuit, the state laws that have been in place decades before COVID are favoring the doctors. So early on in Grace's case, I really thought we'd never file a case because I talked with the best medical malpractice attorney in Wisconsin, and he told me that, Scott, even in slam dunk cases like this appears to be, we only have a 1 in 10 chance of winning. And so I said, what's the reason? And he said, well, I'll give you a story. He said, I represented a family where the husband had a sponge sewed up inside of him in a surgery and we lost. So, well, how is that possible? He said, I brought in 10 experts and they brought in 100. So in the case that we're up against Ascension Hospital System, they're the second largest nonprofit mm-hmm. in yeah. the United States. They're the largest Catholic hospital system. They have $30 billion in cash reserves. They received $10 billion in government bonus payments in the first year of COVID. That's who we're up against. So just think through that David versus Goliath story, just as a starting really? Point. But then even more important than what I just shared is the limitations on liability by state statute. In the absolute best case scenario, which I don't think that we have that, but in the best case scenario, the most that we can receive in Grace's case is $750,000. So we've already said we're not taking any money, but if we get awarded $750,000, in the typical lawsuit arrangement, the law firm gets one third, $250,000. So just think, if there's a 1 in 10 chance of winning, that's the equivalent of $25,000. Just the experts alone will be $100,000 in Grace's case. So no law firm is going to take these cases on. So hence, we're using our own money to fund the case because you can't get a law firm to take these cases on. So what's the reason they've limited the liability? They claim because we can't get any doctors to practice in our state unless we have limits of liability. So that's what we're up against. This cabal has been set up for decades. In, you know, COVID, all COVID did was expose it.
Right. I think exactly right. And it is true that the part of that is true is that, and because I was a victim of the malpractice costs at one point, and I was in private practice. It gets so expensive you can't afford to practice. But that's part of the setup they made. It's like they set up these young doctors to all be owing so much for their medical education that they can't afford, that they couldn't, and then made this being on a private practice so difficult, so complex, they all work for the hospitals now. It was right. Corralling them all in so they could be told what to do. Now, that's the hard part I have. Did any of the doctors explain to you why she was sedated? I mean, did any of them feel bad about any of this being done?
What's strange is that there's a, so the hospitalist is the doctor that you have the regular contact with. And it's interesting to me because as I look at this now and see their notes in the records and my experience with the hospitalist, I see them as the person who's in charge of selling you. So there was, you know, the only time we ever got anything close to informed consent was when he was convincing us that Grace should get nutrition that during that phone call on the last day. And Grace had already had a central line-in, so she could have received TPN food. But he convinced us that, well, we should put a feeding tube in. Remember, this is her last day on Earth. And he starts saying, Grace had such a good day, let's work on nutrition. So, I mean, he gave us kind of a quasi-informed consent with the feeding tube. But then how they would do this, so the hospitalist, I'll just give you a very specific example. The first time we denied the ventilator, I didn't have a clue about ventilators. But I challenged what was the basis for that recommendation. And they told me about a blood gas draw they had done the night before. And I said, I don't think that draw is objective because we were wrestling with Grace with a BiPAP mask. I said, I'd like you to retake the draw. So they did, and Grace was fine. Well, then the hospitalist comes in. So now I start researching ventilators because I was under the paradigm that President Trump had set up, that, you know, we have a ventilator shortage. So I just thought it was a tool in the tool chest. But then I thought, what is going on here? Because he told me, I said, what's the prognosis if Grace has to go on a ventilator? And he said, only 20% of people walk out alive once they're on a ventilator. So then I thought, whoa, what is going on? So I started researching and realized we're not doing a ventilator. It's not a tool we should be using in COVID. Well, then the hospitalist came in and said, well, isn't a 20% chance better than no chance? So that's how they set it up. And the hospitalist is got a different type of a personality than a typical doctor. He's the nice guy. And so this nice guy comes in.
Wait a minute, the rest of us are not.
Well, I mean, I can give you some stories from Grace's hospital visit. It's like, these guys are on an ego trip. But the hospitalist was actually decent, you know, but he was trying to sell me on this idea of a ventilator because, you know, they were framing Grace as near death. Well, I mean, I was with her. She was doing fine.
You know, but he's like the used car salesman then. He's the guy that schmoozes you and gets you to sign things.
Well, that's the way I looked at it after the fact. When I, you know, you start putting the pieces together, and you realize, oh my gosh, there's a whole narrative. They're trying to accomplish a narrative based on the financial gain if they can convince you to do X, Y, and Z.
You know, I spent my whole life as a surgeon and a spine surgeon, so I was married to big hospital my whole career. I never saw anything like this. I really never did. We all didn't work for the hospital. In fact, I can remember the day when we had a medical staff meeting at this was a 250-bed hospital, 220 doctors on staff. We had a big medical staff meeting because we were upset that they were choosing a guy who was an ER doc to be on the medical board as a medical representative, as a physician representative, because he worked for the hospital. You know, that's how far we've fallen in less than 20 years. And that's these guys are now, they're just, you know, servants of the hospital structure.
Well, I agree. And, you know, the thing that I have learned is not just servants of the hospital structure, but what is the hospital structure a servant of? And it seems that the training has gone along the lines of collectivism. That's the consistent thread. So the idea that we need to do things for the good of society versus the good of the individual seems to be indoctrinated. And I have documents that I have found, some which a lot of people would be aware of, but I found some specifically related to Down syndrome. And then you see how they're trained. So how are they trained to look at somebody with Down syndrome? And you can see why they would want to kill Grace, because they're trained that she is a useless eater. And I mean, you obviously are familiar with Obamacare. Well, Obamacare was passed on March 23rd of 2010. So, I mean, this is already 13 years ago. So Obamacare codified the spirit of collectivism. And so all of a sudden they crossed the T's and dotted the I's. And so you think, well, I'm not on Obamacare. Well, that doesn't matter. Obamacare, the provisions of Obamacare set the standards that the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services have to follow, which then that becomes all the insurance company standards. So everybody's following this. And Ezekiel Emanuel, who is the chief architect of Obamacare, I mean, his statement is all the way through Obamacare, which his statement, I'm going to read this quote. He said, services provided to individuals who are irreversibly prevented from being or becoming participating citizens are not basic and should not be guaranteed. So you just think through this. Before COVID, there were 62 million Americans on Medicare and Medicaid. Now there's 100 million. I believe on purpose. The rules were relaxed on purpose. Why? Because of the agenda to reduce the population. It's under the guise of we have to control the budget. So now 50% of the annual federal budget goes to fund the bureaucracies of Medicare and Medicaid. So in this idea of collectivism, we need to reduce these costs that are out of control. So how do you do that? Well, Obamacare does it. Well, and I want to be very specific. We have a break coming up, so I'm going to have to do this.
Well, you got a minute. You can go for a minute. We'll get.
Okay. So the provision of Obamacare that applies here. This is on page 141 of 906. Obamacare's 906 pages. It's section 1553. And it's called the Prohibition Against Discrimination on Assisted Suicide. And it says specifically, the government may not subject an individual, doctor, or institutional healthcare facility, hospital, to discrimination on the basis that entity does not provide any healthcare item or service furnished for the purpose of causing or the purpose of assisting in causing the death of any individual, such as by assisted suicide, euthanasia, or mercy killing. So they're telling us right in writing that if a doctor doesn't want to participate in mercy killing, euthanasia, or assisted suicide, he can't be discriminated against. So they're telling us this is how they're going to kill us. It's right there.
And the hospital can't be discriminated against for doing those things.
That's exactly right.
It protects the hospital. That's an amazing statement. We'll be back here in just a minute. Use the code REBEL when you go to the store. Scott Shara, more to follow.
Nearly all the vitamin C sold at retail today comes from China, and it's made from genetically modified corn. Even though vitamin C is a critical part of immune support, it's also critical to know where your vitamin C comes from. I'm Mike Adams, the founder of Brighteon and BrighteonStore.com. And we only sell non-China, non-GMO vitamin C. We then subject it to rigorous laboratory testing in our own food science lab, checking for heavy metals, glyphosate, as well as microbiological contamination. Only after it passes our tests do we encapsulate it and package it for our audience. You can find it at BrighteonStore.com. It's not the cheapest vitamin C on the market, but it is by far the most rigorously tested and honestly sourced vitamin C available anywhere in the world. Support your health and this free speech platform by shopping at BrighteonStore.com. If you don't want to eat GMOs and pesticides in your storable food, choose organic, lab-tested storable food solutions from the Health Ranger store. We are the only emergency food manufacturer in the world that subjects each of our ingredients to rigorous laboratory testing that covers herbicides, heavy metals, aflatoxins, identity testing, and bacteria tests, including E. coli, salmonella, yeast, and mold. At healthrangerstore.com, you'll find certified organic, lab-tested, freeze-dried fruits, microalgae superfoods, protein powders, and supplements. We offer emergency first aid colloidal silver products made with Texas rainwater, and our Ranger buckets feature an impressive assortment of organic storable food items professionally vacuum sealed in heavy-duty bags that are stacked in rugged buckets for long-term storage. Check out our preparedness foods, supplements, personal care, and emergency first aid products at healthrangerstore.com.
Hello, Brighteon. This is Samuel McGuire. I just want to tell you about my podcast. You can find it on Apple, Spotify, and Anchor, and also Rumble. It's the Samuel McGuire Show. I also have social media on all platforms. You can check me out at Samuel McGuire. Thank you so much for listening to Brighteon, and I hope you listen to my show.
Thanks for watching Brighteon, and you can find me, Patrick Byrne, at patrickbyrne.locals.com or on Twitter.
I'm Anna with The Flame.
I'm Nicole with The Flame.
And you can find us at theflameusa.com. Make sure to go there and subscribe to the fastest growing paper to get people out of the movable middle so we can save our country.
And thank you, Brighteon, for just having us on. We so appreciate you.
All righty, thank you very much. And we're here with Scott Shara, whose daughter, Grace, was essentially murdered by modern medicine and our current COVID-age medical system. But we were talking about the idea that some people are not worthy of living, essentially. That's why they don't give them any resources. They don't send money their way. And Ezekiel, you mentioned Ezekiel Emanuel. I was at a Georgetown University debate one time years ago, and I brought up his paper that he had just published. It was about the disability adjusted life year. And in that paper, Dr. Emanuel claimed that he had a formula to determine how much each year of your life or my life or Grace's life was worth. And that because, you know, they wanted to get, this is just pre-Obamacare, but they wanted to get all the money together. And they just were salivating over all these healthcare dollars. And they said, and when we finally get control of all these healthcare dollars, in order to dole it out fairly, okay, we're going to have to be able to codify people's worth. And this was how they did it, the disability adjusted life care. And I said, this is just right out of the German experience. And for people that don't know, I mean, there was, I got interested in that because of Karl Brandt, who was the chief of medicine for Hitler at the end of the war. But he was a surgeon. He was actually a good guy, but he believed an evil principle, and that is that when the life of the nation matters, the life of the individual doesn't count. And he trained with a guy named Alfred Hoche, and Hoche was a psychiatrist who co-authored with his partner, who was a lawyer. It was a book called Permission for the Destruction of Life Unworthy of Life. That's the world we're in right now. And Ezekiel Emanuel, if you look at that paper, he's got a bell-shaped curve about where the dollars are going to go. And I think I was, now I'm 70, I think I was 60 at the time. But essentially, anybody over 60 and anybody under 2 was going to be getting $0. So we are the people he's talking about now. It's not just Grace. It's a lot of other people.
It's not a joke. I mean, concepts. Yeah, these are not concepts anymore. I dug into this for a presentation I did, and the NIH already has frailty scoring. They have futility scoring. So these are all in play. Legal document, when they're, you know, I would say they're illegal documents, but these are the documents, the training documents that they're using to determine what type of care you should receive. And believe me, if you're on Medicare and Medicaid, you know, you watch out. You know, you think you're finally have free health insurance. I would encourage you to get off of that as fast as possible, because it is a death sentence if you end up having to go into a hospital setting. You know, the as it applies to Grace, you know, I took this way beyond Grace, but I mean, the thing that I was telling you at the break about the smoking gun I found with Grace is the training document. This is what I'm reading from, is from the Palliative Care Network of Wisconsin. So we're from Wisconsin, but you can just put in your state, because this is in all 50 states. So this is how they convince these doctors that somebody's life is not worth living. So this is called Palliative Care for Patients with Down Syndrome. It is written by 2 MDs, and it is a training document for MDs. And so they start with, so this is for how to treat Down syndrome patients. They start with a title called Causes of Morbidity and Death in Down Syndrome. And they lay out about 50 different problems Down syndrome people have. And so they have dental issues, cardiac septal defects, thyroid dysfunction, blah, 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 blah. So they don't say anything good. I mean, I would say relative to my experience with Down syndrome, everything was good. I never saw any of these problems. I mean, of course, Grace had some problems, but I mean, the benefits far outweighed the problems. But they do this for a specific reason. So now in the same document, they make a transition statement. So they list all the problems, and then they they are trying to set up a mindset. And the mindset is this: the lifelong toll on families is high. So you can see, okay, when you see all these problems, think, wow, these families don't want this child. Part of a robust plan of care includes acknowledgement of this toll by the healthcare workers. So they want the healthcare worker to have the mindset, the family doesn't want this problem child because of all these medical problems. So then they set up the killing statement. So this is the license to kill. It says specifically, whenever possible, decision makers for people with Down syndrome, that's the doctor, should be encouraged to use substituted judgment, that's their judgment, to make key palliative care decisions. All efforts should be made to determine the preferences of the patient. However, because of lifelong cognitive impairment, the views of the person with Down syndrome may not be known. So try to wrap your head around that foolishness. I know what the view of every single Down syndrome person on the planet is, the same as yours and mine. They want to live. So what gives the right, you know, of the doctor to choose the death of the person with Down syndrome? Well, it's because the lifelong toll. It's all these problems. So you can see it's part of the programming. They've been programmed, and this isn't just this document. This is a recent document. They've been programming the doctors for years. When Grace was born, you know, I suspected she had Down syndrome just by the way she looked. We had never done any testing. The doctors came in the room after they had a meeting and said, "We suspect your daughter has Down syndrome. Do you want to keep her?" This was 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Right? Oh, so yeah. 70% of Down syndrome children are murdered before they're born right now in the United States. So there's a whole mindset. It's all part of the program. And it isn't just Down syndrome. You know, it's the elderly. It's, you know, anybody that they decide doesn't fit with the obedient taxpaying citizen.
Right. And, you know, I mean, in the Netherlands, I want to say something about the Netherlands in regards to this, because this isn't just about Down syndrome. You know, in World War II, actually, when the Nazis marched into Holland, they said, well, now you guys, you doctors, you're all part of our medical system. They were horrified. The Dutch doctors were horrified that this was going on, that they did euthanasia and that they, you know, they had all this stuff going on where they could, you know, put people to death after a committee looked at it, things like that, because they weren't valuable to society. So the Dutch doctors said, we're family doctors. We live in the community with these people. These are our friends, our family, you know, our associates. We're not going to participate in that. And the Nazis said, if you don't do that, we're going to take away your medical licenses. Well, boom. Almost 100% of the Dutch doctors gave away their medical licenses rather than participate all this. Well, then fast forward to the late 1990s. According to the British Medical Journal, 8% of IFA deaths were euthanasia for deformity in 1997, and 31% of pediatricians admitted in euthanizing children. Under the age of 10, your physician in the Netherlands was the number one cause of death. And these doctors are the children and the grandchildren of those doctors that bravely gave up their licenses rather than participate in euthanasia with the Nazis. And I think one of the fun, it would be funny if it weren't so tragic, but one of the funniest things in this whole thing is, and they actually have this is what got the comment. They actually have this Dutch mobile euthanasia program. So I guess if you don't feel good one day and you want to commit suicide, you just call 1-800-KILL-ME, and this thing buzzes around and it puts you to sleep in this van. But guess who complained about the Netherlands and acting this way? It was the Germans. They said this whole thing that they're doing says this is an inhuman proposal. That was the German Hospice Association. So how the world comes around. But that's because people in America right now, they cannot believe this, because it's like J. Edgar Hoover said, you know, when the individual is handicapped by coming face to face with a conspiracy so monstrous, he cannot believe it exists. This is so monstrous. People cannot believe that in their lifetime, their medical system has gone to the toilet like this.
Well, I think that's accurate. I mean, certainly that's what I see when I get resistance to what I'm talking about. And what I'd like to share in that vein is the United States is number one out of all 200 countries on the planet with COVID deaths in hospitals. So with a death certificate labeled COVID in a hospital, 1.2 million Americans have already lost their lives in the last 39 months in the COVID era. And we're number one. And what's surprising is number two is India. India has four times the population of the United States, and yet their death toll is 531,000. So that statistic should shock anybody into at least digging, say something is going on here. And if that doesn't shock you into saying something, I've got to look beyond what I see on CNN. I've got to look beyond this because they're not telling me the truth. That statistic alone should do that for anybody listening.
Absolutely. I honestly think there are two groups of people in the world now. People that sit, that expect to passively get their news from even Fox. You know, Fox lies by omission. They just don't tell you things that you need to know. The others lie by commission, you know. But yeah, there are people that just sit back and wait for it. And they think, well, if it were true, it would be on these networks. No, right. It doesn't work that way. You got to, you know, And, you know, the other thing is, and I said this 25 years ago, but this is what we'd been saying at AAPS. It wasn't like there weren't doctors out there speaking against this. I said this at a talk. I said that you don't really have to fight evil if you understand the underpinnings of evil, if you can recognize it at its beginnings. And see, we could see that in 1995. And this is just the culmination of it. I just never expected to see it this bad and in my lifetime. And I had that same speech. I had a picture of a bus hanging over the edge of the cliff. And I said, you know, the problem with Karl Brandt and some of these doctors in Nazi Germany is they just didn't get off the bus in time. They could see their country going down this evil rat hole, but they didn't get off in time. And I said, will we know to get off in time? Well, now we know the answer. No, we don't. Right. We didn't get off the bus. And if we just all walk away from this and don't participate in evil, you know, as much as I hate to say it, Albert Bourla hasn't killed one person with the injections. It's all the hands of the little people. It's us they use. We do it. Those doctors did it to your daughter, those nurses in the hospital. And I would have nurses contact me and say, I want to tell you this because, you know, this is happening in my hospital. I said, well, why don't you speak out? I said, well, I don't want to lose my job. I said, you just told me you work in Auschwitz. You know, come on.
Well, that's real stuff. I have two very pointed stories that I'll share relative to what's going on. And so one of them was with a hospital rescue. My wife and I rescued a disabled man from a Green Bay, Wisconsin hospital in November of 22. And when we got him out, so we're now in the room with the man, his sister and his mom, my wife and I, and the nurse. And she was decent. You know, when we had to take him out AMA, they wouldn't even remove his IVs because he refused to sign the AMA form. So a kind nurse came in. And she was from the Philippines. And I, you know, so now we're all standing there. I said, I'd like to ask you a question because I may never have this opportunity again. I said, you know, they were going to kill him. They had already given him 6 doses of remdesivir. And he had SMA, only weighed 40 pounds. So, I mean, when we got there, he was almost dead. And so when I said to her, you know, they were going to kill him, yet you participated. Can you explain? And she said, I'm from the Philippines, and if I don't do exactly what they say, they'll deport me. So you just...
Oh, that is what Tom Rentz said. He just, you know, he just dropped that bomb about how there was a killing floor on this hospital that where it was overt. The nurse was complaining. And I said to him, how are these people going along? And he says, we think they're importing nurses and doctors. And it has to do with, because I said, I can't imagine how we could do that with non-foreigners. It's foreigners. Oh, my gosh.
Well, then the second one I want to share with you happened about 2 months ago. So early on, I mean, I started speaking out and Wisconsin Christian News is a newspaper that did an article on Grace's story. And the reporter who did the article lives next door to a nurse from Appleton, Wisconsin, the city where Grace was killed. And she called the reporter and said, that man is lying, and specifically about the illegal do not resuscitate order. Well, then about 2 months ago, that same nurse called the same reporter and said, he's not lying. And she said, well, how do you know that? And she said, well, I'm the power of attorney for my dad, and he's in the hospital I work at, And I was reviewing his chart, and the doctor put an illegal do not resuscitate order on him. So I said to the reporter, I said, do you think that she will talk with me? So she arranged it. I ended up talking with this nurse. And so then after she explained, and you know, she realized that, you know, she was throwing me under the bus incorrectly, I said, will you come on the air with me and share this? I said, people are dying and they need to know. And she said, I can't. She said, I'm 66 years old. I'm a year away from retirement, and I can't jeopardize my job. So that's sad. So that's, you know, that is so sad. Where we are at. I mean, we know based on studying World War II that the Jewish leaders and the Christian pastors of the time led the Jews to the gas chambers. They all knew what was going on, but they didn't want to. They didn't want to get involved. And, you know, here we have the medical profession, you know, they have to know what's going on. And I see the Christian pastors in the same boat because I've been studying that also. I mean, they're not warned. We left the church that we were participating in because of that. The watered down version of Romans 13 and 14. I mean, my gosh, people are being murdered and you won't even tell the truth about the jab. I mean, this is crazy.
Or they set up vaccine things in their churches. Now, in contradistinction of that, I just want to bring out, I've had both Pastor Paul Blair and others on, but he and his co-pastor run the Black Robe. They're standing up the Liberty pastor. So
outstanding. I have met some fantastic pastors as part of this also.
And that's what they're doing, is teaching pastors to speak the words of liberty. So if you have a pastor you want to get involved, that's the Liberty Pastors of Edmond, Oklahoma.
How do you drag them to the meeting? The ones
Well, they actually do. You know, they actually have a very nice meeting. They go to nice hotels. They have a good, that's how I know about them, because I started speaking for them. And I love those guys, Dan Fisher and Paul Blair, and they really walk the walk. So I think there's hope there too. I think that people are starting to, it's a full auditorium now whenever they have it. So,
boy, that is really good to hear. I mean, there is a lot of work to do if we're gonna turn this ship around. It's way deeper than what I would have ever thought, because they have the whole ground game set up.
Yeah. Could you talk a little about your rescue mission though? I think that would be good to hear.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, it was really quite an interesting. It's more than interesting. It's a miracle. So, you know, early on, we realized we need to speak out so Grace's death is not in vain. Well, we have a billboard campaign, and you know, ultimately, a lady had seen our billboards, and she contacted a friend of a friend, and all of a sudden I'm on the phone with her because I didn't know who she was. And she called me, her name is Heather. And she said, my brother, his name is Robert, is in the hospital. Can you help me? And I said, well, tell me what's going on. And she said, well, he was diagnosed with COVID. He's got SMA. And, you know, ultimately I said, this is going to sound crazy, but this is urgent. I said, they're going to try to kill him. And to my shock, she listened. So this was on November 3rd. So I said, can you advocate for him? Because it's critical that somebody is in that room advocating. And I said, who's in the room right now? She said, my mom. And I said, is her personality such that she can advocate? And she said, no, not really, but I'll be there. She said, I'm strong and I can do it. So fine. All right. So you got to make sure you don't let them put a DNR on him, no jabs, no more COVID testing, no remdesivir. I went right down the list of things that she needed to make sure she knew. Well, the following evening, about 11 p.m., I was already in bed. She texted me, and she said they already gave him remdesivir. So then, you know, it now became from urgent, it's an emergency. So I got a hold of her first thing. This is on Saturday morning, the 5th of November. And I said, this is, we got to stop this. This is urgent. And her brother wasn't quite convinced that a dad is going to know more than the doctor yet. So he said, well, can he send me anything? He was still cognizant. So can he send me anything about remdesivir? So I emailed her some documents. She showed him and he said, see if Scott will come to the hospital. So she called me and said, will you come? And I said, yes, I'll be there in a half hour. And so, you know, I just took off and got to the hospital. On the way, I talked with two ladies who have done rescues. So, I mean, I had never done a rescue. So they educated me. They said, you need to get this medical directives form. So I swung by a local credit union to print it because they were emailing me while I was driving. And so we got the medical directives form printed, got in the hospital, and I sat down. You know, the most powerful piece of the story is right when I got there. And I see Robert. He's in bed. He's naked. He's hardly breathing, and I prayed with him, and he looked me in the eye and said, Scott, please don't leave. And I said, I won't. And, you know, wow. Ultimately, we went through the medical directives form with him and his sister, his power of attorney. He agreed with everything. Then we met with the doctor. So the doctor, that was the moment. Actually, before we met with the doctor, another miracle happened. So I had met Dr. Peter McCullough along the way, and I texted him. I said, I need your help with what can we give him to help him out as fast as possible. He said, I'm busy today, call Paul Merrick. I said, I only have Paul Merrick's home number. What's his cell number? So Paul Merrick calls the hospital a few minutes later. We transcribe everything he's recommending. And so I called my wife. I said, I need to have this, you know, the ivermectin. And, you know, I had it all at home. She said, how can I come in the hospital with this stuff? They're not going to let me in. I said, just come on in. It's open door here. It wasn't like under guard when Grace was there. So she comes in. We get a concoction together, gave Robert the first concoction of the vitamins and ivermectin. Then we had the meeting with the doctor. So he comes in a spacesuit. You know, because, you know, it's all part of this, you know, the scare tactic. And so then we lay the law down with the medical directives form. To my surprise, 45 minutes later, so now we've already established, we're now in charge of this man's care. The hospital, you know, we're not doing any of this anymore. No more remdesivir, no more. A nurse came in 45 minutes later to give him the COVID flu jab.
Oh my gosh.
So, I mean, that's really what people need to take home from right. That story is that the forms are critical, but there's never been a set of forms that can save your life. You've got to advocate, and it is not the time to be nice. It is the time to be firm, and you are in charge of your health care, and you need to get informed consent for everything.
Right. And they don't. So you have to watch them. You know, you just have to keep your eye on them like a hawk, because you're now, you know, it's sad. The sad truth is that there are citizens with no medical training that can treat COVID better than our highly trained people. That's the world we live in. Well, listen, I'm sorry we could talk to you for another hour, but thank you so much for coming. And, you know, God bless you for everything you're doing. And I hope you can rescue a lot more people. And just by getting your word out, I know you're saving a lot of people. So we appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks for having
me. We'll see you guys next week.